have an incredible opportunity in Herbalife. And the great thing about the opportunity, it doesn't care who you are. It doesn't make any difference what your background is. It doesn't make any difference what color of skin you got. It doesn't make any difference what religion you are. It doesn't make any difference what kind of place you are as far as how much money you're making. Herbalife will accept anybody who wants to talk good about Herbalife and go out into the marketplace.
That was Herbalife founder Mark Hughes, who died back in 2000, giving the sales pitch the company still trumpets today. It's a sales pitch that's drawn the scrutiny of the Federal Trade Commission, which opened an investigation yesterday into whether the company operates as a pyramid scheme. Herbalife is based here in Los Angeles. It sells vitamins, protein shakes, and other health supplements, but you won't find them at your local grocery store. The company relies on about 3 million independent distributors worldwide to move its products. Herbalife has almost $5 billion in sales last year, and it has some high-profile boosters. Former L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa became a senior advisor to the company after he left office last year. Well, in a moment, why a billionaire hedge fund investor pushed for the government investigation. But before we get into that, let's take a ground-level look at Herbalife. Renee Safer has been selling those products for 30 years now, and she joins me now. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline. Thank you so much for having me on your call.
Well, it's my pleasure. Tell me, how did you get into this?
That's a great question. It actually was kind of accidental. My background is as a real estate broker in Los Angeles, and I became a real estate broker so that I could be home with my children, going through a divorce. And, of course, it backfired. I was working 7 days a week and never saw them. So when my brother-in-law called and told me about an opportunity to be home with my children, I decided to look into it. I thought it would be wonderful if I could not work 7 days a week and really be a present parent. And I had just remarried. I had a new baby. And it was something that I really wanted to check into for personal reasons.
So, and you stuck with it for 30 years. How do you sell your products? Who do you sell them to?
Oh, my. That's a great question. I think that when we look at the world today, with the obesity epidemic, with people with digestive disorders, energy issues, everyone really could benefit from great nutrition. So I think that the market for our products is unlimited because we deal with nutrition, and certainly improving the health and nutrition of the world is a priority. Mm-hmm.
And who do you sell the products to?
Oh, it's so varied. I can't even give you a common denominator. I sell products to people who come to me for different reasons. Basically, I'm a product of the products. I'm 67 years old. I'm still a size 4. And I'm very active with yoga and hiking. I have grandchildren. I have grown children. So I'm really kind of an example of what focusing on your diet and your nutrition can do as you get older.
I can tell you're a really good salesperson.
Well, I love what I do. And actually, I feel like I'm sharing more than selling. I'm very excited about what these products have done for me.
Uh-huh. Well, you know what people do say about the company. People who are detractors of the company say it's a pyramid scheme and that people actually make money by just selling to other people who then need to sell to other people, that they're not actually selling outside the company.
You know, it's so interesting that you said that because I heard your introduction that we sell products. And the definition of a pyramid scheme, as I understand it, is that there is no product and there is no end user. And my personal experience, my reality is that I have always been taught by Mark Hughes, by everyone involved with Herbalife, that without our products, we wouldn't exist. We are a product-based company. Mm-hmm. And I think that is in direct conflict with the definition of pyramid.
Well, there can be a product. It just depends on who's buying them. And if it's actually being sold to people who then don't need to sell them again to make their money back.
Yeah, well, my clients don't need to sell anything. They just need to get results and be happy.
Right. So you sell them to people outside who are not salespeople.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I have a huge customer base, and most of them are really not interested in selling anything. They want to get product results. They may have been referred to me by a friend who got good results. And I think that's really the bottom line. It all starts with the products, and I started with the products. My first step with Herbalife was to become a product user, because I felt that I needed to get these products into me and see if they made a difference for me. And they made such a big difference. I lost 10 pounds in 2 weeks with three children. My energy went up. I felt great. And I thought, gosh, why would I not want to share this with people?
But is there any pressure on the part of people above you, your managers, to say you need to sell a certain amount, you need to move a certain amount of product, and you need to get a certain amount of people selling the product?
No one has ever used those words to me.
But is maybe not those exact words, but is that the message that you get from management at all?
Never. Never. That is absolutely a non-issue. And in fact, it's really just the opposite. The way that it's presented is that this is an opportunity if you choose to take advantage of it. And if all you want to do is be a consumer, we love you.
And how much money, if I may ask, do you make on average?
You know, I don't really want to discuss the exact amount, but I can tell you that it was enough for me to get out of the real estate business within a few months. I've been able to stay home and be present for my kids, and I'm really proud of the fact that I've had an influence on them. I think it's been a great influence to see me involved in something where I was passionate about it and I had integrity and I really focused on making the world better rather than making money.
Mm-hmm.
The money has been substantial over the years, but it's not something that I pitch. I don't really talk about the money that I make. I just let people know that based on their own efforts, if they work a little, they can make a little money. And if they work hard like I do, they can make a lot of money. It really is about individual efforts.
All right. Renee Safer, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Renee Safer has been selling Herbalife products for 30 years. And we want to hear from you. If you've had any experiences with Herbalife, you can give us a call, leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, the Press Play Facebook page. All right, so that's how it works. Back to the news of the day. There's a hedge fund guy named Bill Ackman, and he is leading the crusade against Herbalife.
The important thing here is we want the little guy distributor to understand the facts about his or her probability of being successful and getting to the top of the food chain here. 99.9 plus percent of the people don't make money or net of expenses make a nominal amount of money and spend enormous time and energy, and they've been sucked in their friends and their family and the people closest to them to something that is a scheme.
So basically, Bill Ackman is saying it's a pyramid scheme, and he's been on this tear for more than a year now. He shorted the company for $1 billion, meaning if the company's stock fails and falls and the company fails, Ackman wins big. Heidi Moore is U.S. Finance and Economics Editor for The Guardian, and she joins us now. Hi there.
Hi.
All right. Tell us more about this guy, Bill Ackman, and why does he really have it in for Herbalife?
Yeah, he's what's called an activist investor. So his job is to find companies that he thinks are doing something wrong and then ringing the alarm about it. And at the same time, he makes a bet that their stock will go down. He'll say that he makes the bet that the stock will go down because the company isn't very good at what it does and it needs to be disciplined or punished. But it's a trend that he has pursued with many other companies. And as a matter of fact, nearly all the activist investors on Wall Street, these, you know, kind of colorful billionaires, are all involved in this deal, in this Herbalife stock, betting against each other. So
really?
It's a particularly, yeah, it's kind of like the Reservoir Dogs of Wall Street right now.
Right,
you know,
Carl Icahn is involved, isn't he?
Yes, exactly. Carl Icahn, at one point, I think Dan Loeb, who's another one, was involved. And they're all very, they cultivate these reputations as hotheads,
yeah,
as these brilliant hotheads who can only see the truth, who are visionaries and can see through a company's BS before anyone else. And so they cultivate that, and they will go to almost any ends to achieve, any means to achieve their ends. And so in the case of Bill Ackman, who's younger, and then Carl Icahn, who's in his 70s, I mean, Carl Icahn came up through the 1980s, through the Gordon Gekko era, and Bill Ackman is much younger, and it's really kind of a generational fight between them over who's going to be the great activist investor, and that depends on who is right about Herbalife.
Hmm.
So Ackman says it's a pyramid scheme. Icahn mainly wants to see Ackman lose money. So they've
had a previous feud, right?
Yeah, exactly. They've gotten into big fights on live television, and you know, and they've gone to sort of all sorts of lengths to see who's right about this. And then, of course, the culmination of this is that this week, Ackman has been lobbying for some time, and he succeeded in getting the Federal Trade Commission to investigate Herbalife.
Right. So let's talk about that and this crossover between finance and politics, because Ackman really just went full court. He lobbied members of Congress. He lobbied the Federal Trade Commission. He spent lots and lots of money getting civil rights groups to also write letters to Congress and to hold protests. So is that kosher, all that he's been doing?
Well, I mean, it's kind of they take an approach that all's fair in love and war, and this is definitely war. And it's something that activist investors do often. In fact, Ackman himself has done it before. There was a bond insurance company called MBIA in the early 2000s, and he was ringing the alarm about how they were not well capitalized and how they would go under, and he called regulators about them too. And that was a 7-year battle. And eventually he was right, but I think that was because of the financial crisis as well. So they really do cultivate this idea of, I am a visionary and I see what's going to happen to this company and none of you see it. And so they do consider it kosher because he, you know, in his point of view, his investment thesis, what he's bet $1 billion on, is that this company is allegedly corrupt. And so he needs to prove it in order to earn that money.
Yeah. So, but is he doing it for the good of the body politic, or is he doing it for the good of his wallet?
Bit of both, you know. I mean, I think you definitely see a kind of martyr complex among a lot of activist investors, and they want to, you know, show that they are sort of Cassandras, you know, that they see the future and they haven't been listened to, and they're going to set things to rights. It's obviously very convenient that they tend to make billions of dollars if they get this right. Another risk, of course, is that often they're wrong. You know, Ackman was wrong about some companies like JCPenney and others that he pursued and tried to change. So, you know, it's a risky bet that they're taking, but from their point of view, you know, they feel like they've done the research and mm-hmm. that this is where they're going to put $1 billion. So you can't accuse them of not putting their money where their mouth is.
Right. Well, what about the Federal Trade Commission? Are they particularly susceptible to billionaire hedge fund investors and their particular pet projects?
Well, you know, human frailty is everywhere. So I wouldn't say that they're never unsusceptible. But, you know, the FTC has looked at alleged pyramid schemes before. In fact, Amway, which a lot of people are familiar with, was alleged to have been a pyramid scheme back in 1979 and cleared itself against an FTC investigation. So those investigations come along every few years, and it's something that the FTC does take seriously. And if you think about it, as a regulator, if you see billions of dollars being traded on this thesis that something is corrupt, what excuse do you have to not investigate, right? I mean, the default is investigation.
Yeah. Well, they could just decide to investigate on their own without being pressured by someone from the outside, I suppose.
In an ideal world, yes.
Right.
But, you know, usually
Silly
regulators
me.
Do need an outside cue. Yeah.
Okay. Well, so the people at Herbalife have responded also with their big lobbying teams as well, not only Carl Icahn, but they've also responded heavily, and I guess they lost in this particular instance. Heidi.
Hi. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess they lost in this particular instance. How will the FTC determine whether this is a pyramid scheme or not? How do they decide that?
Well, they're going to, you know, send investigators, talk to people who work at Herbalife. I mean, talk to dozens, if not hundreds of people. The idea that they need to establish for it to be a pyramid scheme is that people were promised benefits for recruiting other people. So if you're promised payment or product because you recruit other people to the cause, then that is generally what we define as a pyramid scheme. And what Herbalife is a multi-layer marketing scheme, which, you know, some people have kind of conflated with a pyramid scheme. There is a wavy line there, and that's what the FTC is going to be looking to prove. You know, are people who sell Herbalife, you know, actually just selling and finding clients and spreading the word, or are they recruiting others into what is essentially a kind of financial cult? And that's what the FTC needs to find out.
Yeah. So Bill Ackman, did he make a lot of money yesterday after this news came out?
yeah, I mean, you know.
Did the stock go down, in other words?
Yeah, you know, but the thing is, he's in it for something of a long haul, right? Mm. One of the difficulties about following a battle like this is that they don't have to disclose their stock holdings. The guys who are betting on this don't have to disclose their stock holdings very often. So you can't tell if Bill Ackman sold some stock yesterday or bought some stock yesterday or if Icon bought some stock yesterday. All we know is what they, you know, buy and sell every 3 months or so. So it's hard to tell what the overall value of this bet really is, because on Wall Street it gets a little bit complicated. It's not a matter of just buying a stock or betting against a stock. There are a lot of, you know, there are kind of small derivatives that they can buy. Mm. There are ways that they can, what they call hedging their bets. And so it's almost impossible to really tell what's going on in a deal like that. But if you believe that he is purely long on the stock, meaning he just owns it, he bought it, then he probably did very well.
Heidi Moore, U.S. Finance and Economics Editor for The Guardian. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, why aren't there more women in science and tech jobs? Well, it's not for lack of overachievers. In fact, it might be just the opposite. The drive to get straight A's in school may be to blame. That story next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry, you can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, why aren't there more women in science and technology jobs? It's not for a lack of overachievers. In fact, maybe it's the opposite. The drive to get straight A's in school may be to blame. Here to explain is Catherine Rampell. She's an opinion columnist for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Okay, so I don't get this. The drive to get good grades is actually hampering women in their earning potential. What's going on?
Well, so, you know, there are probably a lot of reasons why women earn less money than men and why women are not particularly well represented in some of the highest earning professions. But one issue might be that the track to getting into a lot of those high earning professions involves coursework, involves academic majors that tend to have a tougher grading system. In other words, it's harder to get A's in computer science classes, in math classes, in engineering classes and the like than it is in the humanities, not necessarily just because they assign more work in a lot of cases, but also because the grading curve is different, the distribution of grades is different, and that might be scaring off women.
And so are women just not doing as well as men?
Actually, what's happening is women are getting better grades even within those tough classes. But because the distribution is different, you know, let's say in a humanities class and an English class, you know, 50% of the students in the class get A's. And in a computer science class, 20% of the students get A's. Even if all of those A's go to women, it's still a smaller pool of A's to basically claim. Mm-hmm. So women are doing better than men, but it's a tough enough road to get those very high grades that they're getting discouraged. They see that they're more likely to get a B in a STEM class than in a humanities class, and they think, I must not be good at this.
But why would women think that way and men not?
I think that's a very difficult question. If you look at the data, it does show that women seem much more discouraged by getting something below an A, you know, a B plus or a B or a C for that matter, than men do, that men don't really care. You know, they'll stay with economics or they'll stay with computer science regardless of what grade they get. It could be that the men are more overconfident. You know, men might just be more willing to shrug off that negative feedback and say, hey, that professor doesn't know anything. I'm actually really good at this, and this grade does not reflect my true potential. And maybe the women are more likely to say, oh, this grade is a mediocre grade. That must mean I'm a mediocre talent. Mm. It could also potentially be related to the fact that maybe men are more likely to see themselves as future breadwinners, and they they know that a lot of these fields lead to highly lucrative jobs. And so, you know, they're willing to withstand that negative feedback because they know that they need to gather these skills to attain these skills in order to be more attractive to employers. And maybe women are somewhat more myopic. They just see, I must not be good at this subject, therefore I shouldn't pursue it.
Or maybe they see the results and they say, well, when I get out into the work world, it's going to be so difficult for me to get a job anyway in this field because it is male dominated that if I don't have great grades, I won't get a job in it.
That's possible. That's certainly possible. Like I said, the women who are staying within these fields tend to be kind of the superstars. They tend to be the ones who are getting the A's because the ones who are not getting the A's are getting discouraged and leaving. And you know, they may believe that they really need to excel not only to compete with the women, but because there's a higher standard for women than for men.
So what is the result in terms of how many women actually start their college career in the STEM fields and then exit in the STEM fields? What are the numbers? And then after graduation, what happens in terms of employment?
So I don't know about STEM fields overall. I can tell you that some data that I was looking at from the National Science Foundation, I believe, said that 2.5% of entering female freshmen say they want to major in engineering. And then I think that of all bachelor's degrees awarded in engineering, it goes down to about 1%. I think that was the number.
So
it starts out, I think it was like a little bit less than half. So it starts out with very few women expressing interest, which is problematic. And then even of those precious few, many of them get discouraged. I'm sure that you'll hear different stories from different women. Many of them may say, oh, I found passions elsewhere. I thought that I wanted to be an engineer, and then I decided that classics or whatever or dance history was really what I wanted to do. And I'm sure that's true for some people. What's peculiar is that there only seems to be an outflow. You don't see people coming in. You see the direction, you see basically the movement going in one direction, and that's what's concerning.
And the reason why this is important is because, well, not only for personal fulfillment, but also because the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, and math fields, they earn a lot more money out in the real world than the humanities.
Yes. Yes. So there are a couple. I've gotten a lot of questions about this. You know, why do we care if women aren't going into these fields? You know, if they prefer to pursue something else, why not let them? And I would say that there are two reasons. One is the earnings gap. If you look at the typical salary for people coming out of engineering majors, math, statistics majors, economics, those tend to be the highest median salaries. They're way higher than the salaries that are typically earned by students who come out of the humanities. So if you have women who are sort of excluding themselves from these types of careers because of the choices that they make as sophomores in college, that's probably problematic.
So how does this account for the fact that as of 2011, nearly half of all applicants to medical schools were women?
That's an interesting question. So medical school medicine in general has seen a huge influx of women. The explanation that I have frequently heard about why so many women are going into medicine is that they have realized that this is an incredibly flexible, not to mention high-earning career path. So I think that partly explains it, and maybe that helps people overcome their aversion to the sciences. I don't know, or women overcome their aversion to low grades in the sciences or negative feedback about whether women can be good in the sciences, that sort of thing. And actually, if you look at enrollment or majors rather in STEM fields in the undergraduate setting, biology is actually the only one of the STEM fields that is majority women. Women represent a tiny minority in like computer science and math and some of the others. But biology, for some reason, has done particularly well. I have heard anecdotally that there's some impression that biology classes tend to have more lenient grading curves than some of the other STEM fields. I don't actually know if that's true, and I've been trying to find data on that. Mm. But like I said, I've heard that anecdotally, and I've heard at least that even if it's not true, that maybe people have that impression. But I just don't know if that's borne out by the numbers, because I have not been able to find them yet, alas.
Well, we'll look forward to reading them when you have them. Catherine Rampell is an opinion columnist for The Washington Post, where you can read her column on women and grades at WashingtonPost.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the business of death. Forest Lawn, based here, influenced the funeral industry nationwide and also may have influenced how we view death itself. First, though, let's get a news update with KCRW's Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, death is big business in the United States. The funeral business is a $20 billion a year industry. There are more than 22,000 funeral homes and 100,000 cemeteries. We're beginning a series today on the American way of death, how the funeral business developed and how it's changing. We'll look at big corporations and small at-home services presided over by death doulas. We'll begin with KCRW's Saul Gonzalez and his story about how LA's Forest Lawn Cemetery changed the funeral business for the entire country.
After World War II, the British novelist Evelyn Waugh came to Hollywood to try to sell a film version of his Brideshead Revisited. The studios didn't bite, but the trip wasn't a total loss. After visiting Forest Lawn Cemetery in Glendale, Waugh wrote The Loved One, a satire of the funeral business. It did become a movie in 1965 with an all-star cast. Liberace played the cloying funeral director, Mr. Starker.
I can give you our eternal flame in either perpetual eternal or standard eternal.
Well, what is the difference, actually?
Well, with standard eternal, your flame burns only during visiting hours. It is shut down at night. With your perpetual eternal, your flame is in service 24 hours a day.
Well, I think the perpetual eternal, wouldn't you?
Oh, yes.
Propane or butane, Mr. Barlow.
Evelyn Waugh was exaggerating a bit about what he saw at Forest Lawn, but there's no doubt that Hubert Eaton, the man who created Forest Lawn, helped change how we view and manage death in America.
Way back in 1917, our founder decided that the cemeteries that he looked at and he was exposed to were simply wrong.
Darren Drabing is the president and CEO of Forest Lawn Memorial Parks and Mortuaries.
He thought if someone passed away and they were entering into eternal life, that people should be comforted in that fact. But if he looked at cemeteries of the day with misshapen monuments and literally stone yards and said, this doesn't depict anything like an eternal life. In fact, just the opposite. It just earthly signs of death.
The Missouri-born Eaton was a silver miner in the early 20th century. He'd had his booms and busts before arriving in Southern California looking for opportunity. He set his eyes on a neglected hillside cemetery nearly overgrown by weeds, land that would become the first Forest Lawn. He planted lawns and trees and built copies of European churches and monuments. And he replaced upright headstones with grave plaques that were flush to the ground. That's so people could have uninterrupted views of the softly rolling hills with few obvious reminders of, well, death.
So he said he's going to create a place that looks like a garden. He wants to put fountains. He wants to put noble architecture, artwork, places for the living to come and feel like it's a special place, not a place that feels morbid. He created that in Forest Lawn, and that was just probably the very first innovation.
Eaton's death makeover worked. The lush design and art, some might call it gaudy, turned Forest Lawn into a top Southern California tourist destination for years. No other cemetery can boast a massive stained glass recreation of Michelangelo's Last Supper in its mausoleum. A Last Supper accompanied by an audio presentation. The show plays on a loop.
And here at Forest Lawn Glendale are portrayed the three most significant moments in the life of Christ.
Forest Lawn's founder, Hubert Eaton, who became known simply as the Builder, also introduced market innovations into the cemetery business.
He began the concept of having everything in one place, placing churches, chapels, crematories, funeral homes, flower shops, all in one location for the convenience of the consumer.
One-stop shopping.
One-stop shopping.
Eaton also introduced aggressive marketing, putting Forest Lawn billboards up across Southern California and sponsoring a musical variety show on the radio.
I mean, they're basically acting the way a car salesman would, or any kind of salesman or saleswoman who's trying to sell you everything they can and make the most profit for the company.
Author Bess Lovejoy writes frequently about the history and culture of death in America. She says Forest Lawn was key to commercializing American cemeteries.
Death becomes a big business in America, and it becomes something that's profit-minded. So instead of just having the body care from the home and maybe the local, you know, carpenter is building the coffin, you've got a for-profit business that's trying to sell the family everything that they can, every little accessory, in order to make money. And that's kind of a trend that has continued throughout the 20th century as consumer capitalism has really picked up in general.
Lovejoy also says Forest Lawn was successful, to use a modern term, in rebranding death, making it more serene and cheerful to a culture that didn't want to think much about it.
Forest Lawn really gets to the heart of what somebody like me would call America's death denial. We sort of still have a self-image as a young nation, a nation that's always moving forward, always expanding, always better, endlessly optimistic. And death is hard to square with endless optimism and with endless growth. And so I think, I forget who said this. Someone said death is un-American. It really kind of is.
Forest Lawn struck gold with its formula and has expanded over the decades to encompass 1,400 acres of land in 10 locations. Of course, success breeds criticism, and detractors have seen Forest Lawn as being too perfect, calling it a Disneyland of death. Forest Lawn's president, Darren Drabing, who started at the cemetery as an assistant embalmer in the 1980s, says he's heard all the criticism.
So I don't worry too much about the critics. I know there's thousands of families every year that, you know, entrusted us with the care of their loved one and will continue to. It's a beautiful place.
Ironically, Liberace, one of the people who poked fun at Forest Lawn and the loved one, ended up being buried at Forest Lawn. And they've got plenty of room for your loved ones, too. Their current properties won't be full for at least another 50 years. For KCRW, I'm Saul Gonzalez.
Forest Lawn helped create the modern funeral industry, but Service Corporation International is the biggest player in the death business these days. It operates nearly 2,000 funeral homes and cemeteries in the U.S. and Canada, including Pierce Brothers here in L.A., and it is publicly traded with a market valuation of $4 billion. Things were different before the professionalization of death in America, and it seems like the funeral business is changing again. Sandy Hingston is a writer for Philadelphia Magazine, where she wrote a story called The Death of the Funeral Business. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, we just heard in Saul's piece that Forest Lawn really changed the industry and really ushered in this idea of a serene death, death denial, if you will. And what was it like before that? Were we in, as Americans, in such denial?
For a long time, people were buried at home. In New England and in the South, you can still see roadside family cemeteries, or they were buried at the local church. So we were close to our dead. We saw them every day, or at least on Sundays at the churchyard. But as cities grew and the churches ran out of ground for space for burials, cemeteries were built on the outskirts of town. They were like parks. People would go and visit them with picnic lunches and hang out there with the dead. And I think that we had a different relationship with our dead then. There was more of a sense of continuance between our life on earth and the future life.
So there wasn't this whole disruption between the living and the death, and the death, the dead are safely buried, if you will, away under these rolling lawns, and we don't really see any evidence of them.
Right. You also prepared your dead for burial at home. You washed your dead, you put them in the coffin yourself, and then had them taken out for burial. The professionalization really came in around the Civil War, when embalming became popular, when there were so many soldiers dying far from home and their families wanted to bring those bodies back and bury them, and they needed to preserve them. There was also the shooting of President Lincoln, and then his body was embalmed to be taken on that long train ride home to Springfield, and thousands of people came to see it along the way. So, and the beginning of the 20th century was also the idea of sanitation was taking hold. People were building indoor toilets, they were pasteurizing milk, and embalming was presented to the public as a more sanitary means of bodily disposal than just letting a corpse rot. And so it became a part of the American way of death.
That's really interesting. So it was actually a technological evolution or a technological innovation that contributed to our attitude towards death denial or sanitizing death.
Yes, and cremation was actually originated as the same sort of sanitary procedure. Why deal with a rotting body when you can deal with nice clean ashes instead? So the proponents of cremation in the beginning of the 20th century were also selling it as a more sanitary process.
And so we definitely have a lot of choices when it comes to our funerals these days. We pick out our own caskets. We decide how we want our bodies or the bodies of our loved ones presented. And is that, in your mind, taking us away from the reality of death, or is it actually involving people in the process, at least in the final parts of it?
Interestingly enough, I think it does both. When you go to a funeral director and the funeral director asks you questions like, what would you like the dead to be buried in? Did your beloved have a particular hymn that he liked to sing? Those questions are distracting your mind from what has just happened to you, which is this big hole in your life that's created by the death of a person. At the same time, the increasing personalization of the funeral industry is letting you decide how your beloved will be remembered. You become the cultivator of the image that people will be left with.
So nearly half of Americans now choose to be cremated. When did that happen? When did cremation really take hold?
It's been very recent. In the 1960s, the rate was as low as 3%. It went up to 23%, I think, in 1995, and it is now at 47%. So the changeover has been dramatic, and it sort of crept up on everybody, except maybe funeral directors who have been addressing this at their conventions for a number of years. The rates have gone up dramatically in certain parts of the country and not so dramatically in others. Westerners and Northwesterners were much quicker to turn to cremation. The South, which of course is more traditional, still has low cremation rates. And the rates in cities, especially in northeastern cities that have large Catholic populations, are low, partly because the Catholic Church didn't give permission for cremated remains to be used in funeral masses until the late 1990s. And there are other religious differences, too. Judaism and Islam, Orthodox Judaism and Islam, for instance, forbid cremation.
And how does the American way of death differ from other places in the world, other places like Western Europe, for example?
Europeans have generally been much more open to cremation than Americans. In England today, 3/4 of the dead are cremated. In the rest of the world, disposal of the body really still depends on custom. But I can tell you that there are places in the world where the American way of death, of embalming a body and putting it in a concrete vault in the ground, is the most atrocious thing that you could do, because there are cultures that want to keep as short a space as possible between death and rot. So they believe that the soul rises as the rot is accomplished. So to preserve the body in this state of, you know, semi-decomposition to them is horrible. It's like creating a zombie.
Well, is there more cremation in Europe because there is less church going?
Well, there's also less room. But yes, they are a more secular society. And the rise in cremation in the United States certainly has paralleled the rise, or the decline, rather, in religiosity.
So is that part of, as you write, the death of the funeral business?
It is, and funeral directors are working very hard to try and figure out what they have to offer instead of the traditional way of death. It used to be that when you died, it was a passage from this world to the next, and you were talked about in terms of you had been a good soldier for Christ, you know, you had done your part here in this world, and now you were going on to your reward. The way funerals are crafted today, it's more a celebration of your life here on earth. There's much less emphasis on the hereafter.
Sandy Hingston is a writer for Philadelphia Magazine, and her article is called The Death of the Funeral Business. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And tomorrow on the program, we're going to meet someone who has really personalized the death business. We're going to meet a death doula. Spooky music, Warren Olney.
Really spooky.
All right, you're here to tell us what's on To the Point at 1 o'clock.
I am. You will remember that we built a lot of jails and prisons back in the 70s and 80s when everybody was terrified of crime, and we put a lot of people in and threw away the key. Now, Eric Holder is just among those, including a lot of Republicans, very conservative Republicans, Rand Paul, Cruz of Texas, and others, who want to reduce the mandatory minimum sentencing laws in order to get people out of prison. They're not doing anybody good, and they are really expensive.
Not to mention our prisons are overcrowded.
There's that.
Yeah. Okay, 1 o'clock, and To the Point, Warren Olney. Thank you.
Okay.
And ahead on this show, goodbye, Phil Jackson. No more Kobe. Should the Lakers just pack it in? We'll talk about what happened to the once great basketball team coming up on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, the hits keep coming for the LA Lakers. Kobe Bryant's knee isn't healing quickly enough. He won't be flying in to save the season. And now Phil Jackson is heading to a job in the front office of the New York Knicks. Here's Kobe calling out the Lakers front office yesterday.
Oh, yeah, let's just play next year. Let's just suck again. And no, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know, it's my job to go out there on the court and perform. No excuses for it, right? You got to get things done. Same thing with the front office. The same expectations they have of me when I perform on the court. It's the same expectations I have for them up there.
Bill Plaschke is here now. He's sports columnist for the LA Times. Hi, Bill.
Hey, what's going on?
Well, why don't I ask you that? What's going on with the Lakers?
It's a mess. I mean, it's just a real... It's like the sudden, quick decay of a great, proud franchise, and it all stems from the death of Dr. Jerry Buss, who died about a year ago. And since then, you know, the team has been pretty much thrown into chaos, and they have no direction, they have no leadership. And the problem, I mean, it all stems with the problem is when Dr. Buss died, in his will, he designated that his son, Jim Buss, run the basketball operations and his daughter, Jeannie, run the business operations. Well, Jeannie is more than qualified to run the whole thing, and she's got a really good sense of the whole Lakers. Jim only joined the team several years ago and has really very little experience in doing anything like this.
And then to complicate matters, Jeannie is engaged to Phil Jackson.
And the reason that's complicated matters is Jim has always felt a little jealous of Phil. Guys are generally jealous of their sister's boyfriends, but this is even more so because he's always felt like Phil has kind of lauded his basketball knowledge over Jim and kind of, you know, been very arrogant about it. And Phil can come across that way. I understand that. So he's made Jim Buss feel very insecure. So because of that, you know, you're the boss, you're insecure, you don't like the guy, you don't want him around you. So even though it's been very clear for over a year that Phil Jackson needs to come back to the organization, that he wanted to come back to the organization. Guys won 11 NBA championships, best basketball, NBA basketball coach in history, one of the best basketball minds in history. He, you know, sleeping with one of the co-owners, engaged to her, lives 15 minutes from the building, from the club's training facility, and he wants to come back, and Jim Buss doesn't want him back. So Jim and Jeannie are feuding over this, and caught in the middle of the feud is the Laker fans. These are the children who are the innocent children caught in all this domestic mess. So basically, the reason we're talking about the Lakers now is it's reached a boiling point where Phil Jackson finally said, forget it, the Lakers don't want me to coach, they don't want me to come back and help out, Jim doesn't want me, so the heck with it, I'm going across the country to New York, I'm out of here.
So how is he going to still be with Jeannie, I guess?
That's a great question. That is a great question. I don't, you know, I know, you know, Jeannie's obviously very loyal to the Lakers. You know, she's, you know, again, she's, you know, she's her father's daughter. She has not been to a lot of games lately. She has not. She doesn't show up very much lately. I don't know what would happen with her if he leaves or when he leaves. I don't know how that works out. But I just know that if they let him go, it brings into serious question the fact that whether the Bus children and the family dynamic is allows them to even continue owning this team. And it would not be the first time the Miami Dolphins, Joe Robbie, you know, the Miami Dolphins are an NFL football team, and Joe Robbie was their founder and a wonderful man and built them up, the Dolphins, to be a great NFL franchise. He died, and 4 years later, his children sold the team, and the reason given by their lawyer was family discord. Hmm. They couldn't keep it together. So this wouldn't be the first time.
Right. So how does this crazy dynasty situation, and dynasty, I mean the soap opera, how does that spill over onto the basketball court? How does that account for the fact that the Lakers are doing terribly this season?
Well, for one thing, they don't have a coach that's right for the team or right, you know, who understands the culture. That's Mike D'Antoni. And he was hired. Phil Jackson was tentatively offered a job, and then was pulled away from him, and Jimmy Buss gave it to Mike D'Antoni. So that's the number one thing. That's the number one problem is the coaching. And then the players, they thought they would have Dwight Howard this year. But Jim Buss was the one trying to recruit Dwight, and he's, as opposed to Phil Jackson, who could have done it, Jim Buss tried to recruit him, didn't work, Dwight Howard left. And again, I wasn't a Dwight Howard fan. Frankly, I'm glad he left. But it was embarrassing to the Lakers that they put all their eggs in his basket and couldn't keep him. Mm-hmm. So that leaves them then without basically a credible coach and without basically a star player, because Kobe Bryant got hurt last year. So he's been out all season. And Steve Nash has been out all season with injuries. So this has contributed to all the problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then moving forward, it's even scarier because Jim Buss, again, I keep getting back to this name, Jim Buss, this November, Kobe Bryant had not even returned yet from his Achilles tendon injury, and this is the last year of his contract. This November, Jim Buss gave him a two-year extension worth $48 million, even though he'd never seen him come, didn't know if he could come back from his injury or not. Well, it turns out he couldn't. He only played six games this year. Yet he'll be getting $48 million for the next two seasons. So they're saddled with that, which prohibits them from going and paying better players to join Kobe.
Because of a salary cap.
Yes, exactly. So it's going to be a mess. Madeline, it's going to be a mess for a long, long time, unless they get some clear leadership in there and some direction. Nobody knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
And fans are not, for the first time ever, fans aren't coming to the games. Sponsors don't want to sponsor them. They're not the hot, you know, untouchable property that they have been for so many years.
That is shocking. So do you think that the Clippers can take their place?
No. I mean, we're talking 16 NBA championships versus a team that's never even been in the NBA Finals. So, no, I mean, probably not in our lifetimes, Madeline, but I think that the Clippers can probably make a huge dent this spring. I think if they get to the NBA Finals, they can make a huge dent. But in general, no, it's still going to be a Laker. It'll still be a Laker town and Laker down. But maybe 5 years from now, if it continues on this and the Buses don't sell the team and run it into the ground, possibly. But I think something would happen before that. I think some cooler heads would prevail. I'm thinking either here, one or two things has to happen. Number one, Jeannie, who is in not only in charge of the business operations, but she's the club's representative in the board of governors meeting. So she is officially the last word of the team. Either she just says, you know what, I'm taking over here, Jim. I'm going to hire somebody to do basketball. You can't do it, you know, unless there's a coup by her or unless they sell the team. One of the two things, because it's not working the way it is now.
Okay, so meanwhile, there's the Knicks, and they're also a famous, storied team that is now going through some troubles. And is it possible that just hiring Phil Jackson will turn it around?
You know, so a lot of people question that. I do not, because I saw him work here. He's got such a presence, such an aura about him, such credibility, that he'll come in there and he'll be able to attract free agents that are going to want to play in his organization. Good coaches are going to want to coach for him. Fans are going to want to flock to him because of all the winning he does. That's the only thing in the NBA today, the only thing that really, at the end of the day, with all the bling and all the posses and all the posing in the NBA, the one thing that everyone agrees upon is championships. If you have championship rings, you're the man.
And he has 11 of them.
And he's got 11 of them. So even the most arrogant, spoiled athletes will kowtow to Phil Jackson. They just do. So he has this ability to go in, to move. He'll come in there, and it'll be immediately more credible the minute he walks in. It'll be the same thing as when Doc Rivers took over the Clippers this year.
Hmm.
They immediately became a credible, because Doc's won a championship ring. It's all about the rings. There's not many of them coaches out there who have them, and he's got 11 of them.
Bill Plaschke, sports columnist for the LA Times. Thanks.
All right. See ya.
Jolie Myers is here with the Mail. Hi.
Madeline, hello. We started a conversation today that we're going to pick up tomorrow about the business of death.
Yep.
Our show is not much of a beach read today. Apologies for that, but it's an important topic. It's a tough thing to talk about, but people shared some really touching stories on our Facebook page about mm-hmm. the business decisions or the decisions they had to make when family members passed away. Saran says she's the last of her generation still alive in her family. She's got daughters, so she's got people in her family still, but she says it's on her to tend the graves of her mother, her father, her brother, and so on. But she just can't make herself do it anymore. It's really emotional when she goes to their graves. And she says she feels guilty about not doing that. But her solution is that she's not going to be buried herself so that her daughters don't have to live with the same guilt. So she's already thinking about future generations. A lot of people said that they wanted to be organ donors, that there's a lot of life to give after death, that they want to turn their deaths into a positive experience. One of those people is Diana Davis. I think I just need to read her response because we should have her say it in her voice.
Okay.
Whatever you do, don't flood me with chemicals, waste my good organs, and cram me into a lead-lined box to sit useless forever. Because when the zombie apocalypse happens, I won't be doing no cutesy thriller dance. I'm gonna go after all my former students who never turned in their homework to exact revenge. I like that.
It started off really poignant and then ended on this crazy.
So we can be sure that she's got the little pink dot on her license.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay, and we just want to say one more thing. We want to give a big old shout out to Mario Saavedra, our engineer. This is his first day. He's doing such a good job.
Woo.
Just manning that board like he's been doing it forever. Yay, Mario.
Welcome, Mario.
Yay, okay. And that'll do it for us. Warren Olney is up next with To The Point. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.